It is Wednesday, September 16th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Sarah Williams in Washington. Coming up, fewer refugees are entering Hungary. Some are crossing into Croatia from Serbia. We'll talk with our reporter on the scene. We look at North Korea's nuclear program.
Well, it's important to remember that when North Korea talks about its nuclear weapons, it uses a lot of rhetoric.
U.S. Republican presidential candidates prepare to debate, and we'll hear why Taylor Swift is the biggest female pop star today. It's all ahead. The number of migrants crossing illegally into Hungary dropped steeply on Tuesday, while a few dozen were reported to have crossed into Croatia from Serbia. I'm joined now by Henry Ridgewell, a reporter who is currently in Serbia. Henry, what is the situation so far in within Serbia itself in regard to the migrants?
Well, most of the migrants we've seen and spoken to are very unsure of where they're going to go now and what they're going to do. The sort of information that they need tends to trickle down very slowly through social media, Facebook, through word of mouth, throughout the migrant and refugee community and trail leading all the way up from Greece. So I think it will be some time before all of the migrants decide on a new route, before a new route is established towards Western Europe. The new border controls have been enforced on the Hungarian-Serbian border for just over 24 hours. As you say, that has dramatically had an impact on the number of migrants coming over, and there are probably around 1,000 migrants now camped out waiting at the key crossing point between Serbia and Hungary, a place called Rozce. They are slowly dispersing, slowly making their way along the Hungarian border, perhaps looking for any weaknesses in the link, although it has to be said that the Hungarian police are guarding that border very keenly. So it seems that there are slowly new routes emerging for all these thousands of migrants arriving in Europe. The main one that appears to be emerging now is through Serbia and to the Croatian border rather than the Hungarian border. That's where Serbian buses have been taking the migrants to a town called Sid, which is where I'm heading now to find out what the situation is.
When you say that the border, there is an actual barrier now on along the Hungarian border?
That's correct. A razor wire fence hastily erected in the space of about 2 months over the summer. It consists of a regular wire fence and then several coils of razor wire, three coils high, preventing anybody from crossing. And then at the key border points, so the official border crossing points, the police heavily reinforced those as well. The main crossing point is a motorway is a highway between Serbia and Hungary, the M5, and that has been completely blocked. The migrants, that's where they are camped out. So the main artery, one of the main arteries from Southeast Europe up to Western Europe, is completely blocked. And I've just passed one of the smaller border crossings, and the line of trucks waiting to cross from Serbia into Hungary is about 5 miles long. So this is having not only an impact on the migrants themselves, but a huge impact on normal life here and a huge impact on trade in this area of Europe.
Well, now since a lot of the transport of refugees is now heading more in towards Serbia and Croatia, are officials in those two countries able to work together to negotiate, to deal with this influx of people?
There is more coordination between Serbia and Croatia, certainly, than there has been between Serbia and Hungary. In fact, Serbia stated last night that it had not been officially told by Hungary of Hungary's plans to completely seal off the border as it did on Monday night. And defense has seen relations cool between Budapest and Belgrade considerably. Serbia had been busing the migrants as quickly as possible from the south of the country where they had entered from Macedonia all the way up to the Hungarian border until that border was shut. I think there will be more coordination. Croatia has said it is making preparations. It is making plans for thousands of migrants to arrive on its territory, although it has stated early on that it doesn't plan to allow the free movement of the scale of which we've seen in Serbia and Hungary. But it's very difficult to make plans, I think, for these sorts of numbers. So far, a few hundred have gone over into Croatia from Serbia. some of them have been picked up by the police and processed, and Croatia says it will process their asylum applications or their migration applications in accordance with their national law and in accordance with EU and international laws. But most of these migrants, of course, don't want to stay in Serbia, don't want to go stay in Croatia either. They want to carry on beyond through Slovenia and eventually reach Austria, Germany and beyond. So that's the dilemma for these countries. Do they do what Hungary has done, stop the migrants, try to really enforce the law as it is on paper, or do they simply let them pass through with as little fuss as possible and arrive at their destination?
All right. Thank you very much, Henry. That is Henry Ridgewell reporting. Well, joining me here in the studio is social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. So, Andrew, how does social media, how is it, you know, responding to the continuing crisis in Europe in regard to the refugees?
Well, as the crisis changes, so does the social media. So now we're hearing as these reports, as the borders are closing, we're hearing reaction from a lot of people saying this is terrible, that they're trying to block out these people. And we're seeing, as we've talked about, these migrants using social media. So they're sending word back saying the border's closed, go somewhere else. So I wouldn't be surprised if they're using social media and playing a role in them going to places like Croatia. So it's still continues to be part of this growing story. Top trending topic today on Twitter, top trending hashtag, excuse me, iOS 9. This is the new version of Apple's operating system that they're releasing for iPhone. And it has a lot of security fixes, and that's what a lot of the tech people are talking about on social media. But by and large, people are talking about the kind of bells and whistles. There are going to be some new emojis, including a burrito, which people have been asking for a long time, so they can tell their friends, let's go to Chipotle and send a burrito to them. Some emojis with glasses, so people wearing glasses can now send those emojis. And also a 6-digit passcode, the option. Right now, it's only 4 digits for a passcode for the phone. It can be 6 digits. So a lot of those little bells and whistles, and a lot of people talking about how long it's taking to download it. Said it's been downloading for hours and hours, and they just wanted to download already so they can start using these things. So a lot of buzz about that. There's also a lot of buzz this morning about Facebook. They've decided that they're going to develop a dislike button. Right now, when you have Facebook posts, you like things, but this can become tricky when people post sad news or, you know, news about passing of a family member. You don't necessarily want to like that. So that's why Facebook is saying they're doing this. It's a way to show empathy. It's a way to kind of give a virtual hug. So a lot of people saying that's good for those kind of situations where you can express that. A lot of other people saying it's bad because you don't want to downvote people's posts and make people feel bad and say, oh, I dislike that you went on vacation, or I dislike your kids', you know, photos. And then there are some people who are saying, oh, the people who I disagree with politically, I defriended all of them, but I'm going to refriend them so I can dislike everything they have to say. So it'd be interesting to see how people use that. And then from Twitter, we have two different stories about different elements of commerce on Twitter. One is that Twitter is going to make it easier now to directly donate to candidates. They're going to have an element right in Twitter where you can enter in your debit card information and donate to political candidates. And they also have a program they're using with their buy button. It's going to allow more people to sell things on Twitter. So you can click right on the post and click buy. As previously, only companies and big retailers were able to do this. But now anybody, small businesses, can do this. So it could turn it into a maybe Amazon or eBay-esque website. Certainly, it looks like they're trying to compete with those retailers. So we'll see if it pans out and works.
Yeah, Twitter's looking for some profit there.
Yes, I think so, for sure.
Thanks a lot, Andrew. That's social media editor Andrew Palshevsky. Well, in other news, North Korea Tuesday said it has restarted normal operations at its main Yongbyon nuclear complex and warned it's ready to use nuclear weapons against the United States at any time. The threats constitute a return to the belligerent rhetoric often employed by North Korea in an effort to obtain political concessions from South Korea and the United States, two of its main foes. Kelsey Davenport is the director of nonproliferation policy at the Arms Control Association here in Washington. International Edition's Jeffrey Young speaks with her about these new developments.
Ms. Davenport, tell me what the significance of this event.
Well, it's important to remember that when North Korea talks about its nuclear weapons, it uses a lot of rhetoric. And North Korea has a complex at Yongbyon where some facilities have been operating consistently. However, there are indications that from satellite images that North Korea is expanding some of these areas. But again, it's important to remember this is North Korea, and a lot of what they're saying is simply not true.
What do we know from our side, from what we can see from space, etc.? What confirmation do we have that something really is happening?
Well, we do know that North Korea operates a nuclear reactor that can produce plutonium for nuclear weapons. And we know that they're working on a facility that would allow it to reprocess that plutonium to make the fissile material necessary for a bomb. It's also very likely that North Korea has an enrichment facility at the Yongbyon complex, which could allow it to use and produce enriched uranium for nuclear weapons as well.
How capable is Yongbyon of producing fissile material or plutonium material at a rate that would enable them to build a weapon? How soon and how fast?
Well, North Korea already has nuclear weapons. Most experts assess that they have anywhere between 8 and 15 nuclear weapons. It's difficult to know precisely how many nuclear weapons North Korea can produce in the future because North Korea's nuclear program is closed off. There are no international inspectors, and very few outsiders have actually seen the facilities at the Yongbyon complex where North Korea does most of its nuclear work.
Having a weapon is one thing. Delivering a weapon is another thing. North Korea really doesn't have any viable missile program to deliver a weapon. It doesn't have a miniaturization program that we know of that has successfully put a warhead on a missile.
Well, North Korea seems to be working on miniaturization. The last time North Korea conducted a nuclear test in 2013, North Korea claimed that they had miniaturized a device. And some experts believe that given that this was North Korea's fourth nuclear test, they may have actually miniaturized at that point. They may be able to then mount that warhead on a short-range ballistic missile, which would put parts of South Korea within range. But it's extremely unlikely that it could be reliably delivered or even detonated. But it still poses a threat, and it's important that the international community continue to re-engage with North Korea and then eventually take steps to denuclearize it.
Kelsey Davenport is the Director of Nonproliferation Policy at the Arms Control Association in Washington.
That is Jeffrey Young, and this is VOA.
Here's Science in a Minute.
There are lots of good reasons to quit smoking. Here's another one, keeping your teeth. A new study just published in the Journal of Dental Research shows that men who smoke are up to 3.5 times more likely than non-smoking guys to lose their teeth. Women smokers are 2.5% more likely to lose their teeth than non-smokers. According to the study's lead author, Professor Thomas Dietrich from the UK's University of Birmingham, most people lose their teeth from either tooth decay or gum disease, for which smoking is a risk factor. Smoking can also mask the effects of gum disease, so smokers may not realize the seriousness of their oral problems until it's too late and the teeth start falling out. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
This is International Edition on the Voice of America. I'm Sarah Williams. Coming up, we'll hear the latest about singer Taylor Swift. Republican presidential hopefuls are set to debate at the Ronald Reagan Presidential Library later today. VOA senior political correspondent Jim Malone speaks with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Jim Malone describes how Donald Trump and Ben Carson are leading the polls so far.
They have something in common, along with Carly Fiorina, in that they are political outsiders. They're not professional politicians, and they seem to be driving the interest of voters right now. And, of course, we know that Trump has a lot of bluster. His style is bombastic and in your face. And not only is he not afraid to go on the attack, he's probably the quickest at being able to pivot and respond to an attack for anyone that we've seen in quite a while. Ben Carson's a completely different sort of candidate. He is quieter. He doesn't like to take the bait about getting into these internecine battles with other rivals in the race. But Carson, again, has this political newcomer, neophyte aspect to him that people seem to be interested in right now. They have had a little bit of back and forth. Carson made a comment about religion. Mm-hmm. Trump took that to as a shot at his own kind of religious past. And they seem to have kind of moved on from that. A lot of the folks expect that if there are going to be some fireworks in this second debate, it could be between Donald Trump and Carly Fiorina. Both have been competing for the mantle of sort of the business professional, the person who came from the business world to make an impact in politics. But they've been at each other for several months, and Trump is not shy about pointing out Fiorina's record at Hewlett-Packard, which, you know, is debatable. But there's a real potential for that to take off. And, of course, Fiorina is the only woman in the Republican field right now. Mm-hmm.
This is a rather large debate. A lot of candidates. How many candidates do we have?
This time it'll be 11 candidates. There were 10 in the first debate. So all 10 of those are returning, plus Fiorina, who basically made this debate because she shined in the earlier sort of lesser candidates debate. They're going to have another one of those ahead of the main debate at the Reagan Library. And this will involve four folks because former Virginia Governor Jim Gilmore wasn't able to make the cut. You had to have at least 1% in three national polls, and Gilmore wasn't able to do that. And Rick Perry will not be there, the former Texas governor, because he's dropped out of the race. So the focus will be on this second debate, 11 contenders. And all of them realize right now that Trump is kind of driving the race. And so how they calculate how best to alter that narrative, I think we'll start to see that play out in the debate.
Trump has basically taken all of the media attention. I know some of the cable networks are showing his speeches and rallies, and you just don't see that from the other candidates.
Not only that, I mean, these candidates generally, if you want to appear on programs on the networks or cable networks, you have to show up in a studio generally. You have to be in person. Mm-hmm. Donald Trump is able to call into these programs on a whim, even on the Sunday news shows here in the States. The question is, what is the changes that are going to occur to change the trajectory of this race right now? We don't know, but it would seem the debates would be a logical starting point for someone to try to make an impact, whether they decide to go on the attack against Donald Trump or try something else. I think we're going to start to see that play out on Wednesday night.
Well, there's no debate that we get the best analysis from senior political correspondent Jim Malone. Jim, thank you.
Always a pleasure.
And my thanks to International Edition's Jim Stevenson for that interview. This is VOA.
Hashtag VOA. It's a weekly show, Tuesdays at 1730 UTC, where we bring you the top topics of the week. But the show lives on social media every day with your daily video shorts, What's Trending Wednesday, and the Friday Fast Five. Subscribe to the show at YouTube. You can find us at hashtag VOA. You can reach me at Twitter, at Perry Cal, or talk to the show anytime. Please don't forget to like us on Facebook. We like to be liked. We love to be seen. And you can reach us anytime.
Hi, my name's Larry London. Welcome to Border Crossings, your request and dedication program here at the Voice of America. 1500 Universal, Monday through Friday, we're there for an hour playing your favorite music. You can send an email in and request your favorite songs by your favorite artists. You can also phone in as well. We have great contests and surprise guests from time to time. Border Crossings, every single day during the week at 1500 Universal, here on the Voice of America.
This is International Edition. Well, probably the biggest female pop star today is Taylor Swift. And VOA Border Crossings host Larry London spoke with International Edition's Susan Yaki.
From our music division today, the hottest thing going in the biz, that would be Taylor Swift, of course. And I'm joined here in the studio by the host of our music program, Border Crossings, the famous Larry London. Welcome, Larry.
Well, thank you, Susan. Taylor Swift seems to continue to find ways to get in the mainstream and in the headlines, and whatever it is she's doing, for better or for worse. The latest bit of news about Taylor, there's a couple of things. First of all, congratulations to Taylor on getting 9 nominations.
Outstanding.
9 nominations for the MTV Europe Awards, which will be handed out in October in Milan, Italy. She just came off of a big win at the MTV Video Music Awards here in the U.S. She got the Video of the Year Award, and so now she's up for 9 in Europe. She was named the most popular person, the most followers on social media, with 46.5 million followers on Instagram and 63.5 million followers on Twitter. And her 1989 album is the best-selling album of the year so far. Her earnings this past year, $80 million this past year alone, just in this one year. Now she's got a new song.
You know, I bet
out.
She has a nice place.
I bet she's got a few nice places. A few, as a matter of fact. But her new song is called Wildest Dreams. And this features a different look at Taylor because now she's colored her hair black. And she's taken on the persona of a 1940s film star. A lot of people are connecting her to the look of Elizabeth Taylor in her new video, Wildest Dreams, which is great. It's a great song, and it's another hit off the 1989 album.
Say you'll remember me, standing in a nice dress, staring at the sunset, babe, red lips and rosy cheeks. Say you'll see me again, even if it's just in your wildest dreams. Wildest dreams.
You know, I think she's been hot since she first came onto the scene. I've really enjoyed her music. And one thing I like about her is she has not been raunchy. She hasn't made her fame based on raunchiness. She has real talent, real good look. She's a great dancer, and she's extremely successful.
Yes, she's a good role model, which the music industry has few of. And not only that, she's made the turn from country music to pop music with the new album. This is a very big change for her and her career. And it was a gamble. Her record company were not in favor of this move, but it's turned out successful.
And sometimes we see stars like this that you can see they're going to start to fade. You're going to see, ah, this fad's over with. She's out. But I don't see anywhere that she's dipping at all.
Yeah, she's managed to put her finger on the pulse of music no matter what she does. And, you know, the world is her oyster. Is that what they say?
Yes.
You know, I mean, she's got a big, bright future. She's about to head to Asia for her tour in the fall. So she's getting excited about that, going to China and other places throughout Asia. So it's been a great year for Taylor Swift, and we'll see what happens with the new song.
Well, thank you, Larry, for stopping by.
Thank you, Susan.
That is the music of Taylor Swift. That's our show. I'm Sarah Williams. Thanks for joining us.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
In early September, the U.S. Department of State named as designated global terrorists four men who pose threats to international stability. These designations mean that no U.S. citizen may trade or conduct business of any kind with these men. Also, it allows the United States to freeze their assets, lock them out of the global financial network, and prosecute them for terrorist activities. Samir Kuntar is a Lebanese citizen. In 1979, at the age of 16, Kuntar led four members of the Palestinian Liberation Front, a U.S. Department of State-designated foreign terrorist organization, on a mission to kidnap an Israeli family. The mission failed, and the group took as hostages of opportunity a young Israeli father and his four-year-old daughter. In the course of committing this crime, the terrorists willfully killed both hostages and two police officers. Two of the terrorists died. Kuntar was wounded, arrested, tried for murder, and found guilty. Kuntar was released from prison in 2008, was welcomed by Hezbollah, a U.S. Department of State-designated foreign terrorist organization, and has become one of the group's most visible and popular spokesmen. With the assistance of Iran and Syria, Kuntar has helped to build up Hezbollah's terrorist infrastructure in the Golan Heights. Three active operatives of the Hamas terrorist organization have also been designated global terrorists. Yahya Sinwar and Rawahi Mushtaha are founding members of the forerunner to the Izzedine al-Qassam Brigades, the military arm of Hamas. Their compatriot, Muhammad Deif, has participated in violent activities against Israeli citizens since the mid-1990s. He was involved in deadly bombings of civilian buses, kidnapped Israeli soldiers, and has planned and ordered numerous suicide bombings which have taken the lives of dozens of civilians. By naming Samir Kuntar, Yahya Sinwar, Rohi Mushtaha, and Muhammad Deif as specially designated global terrorists, the United States is taking a decisive step toward ensuring that they and the terrorist organizations with which they are affiliated find it ever more difficult to carry out their acts of violence.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.